saved you one seat. We saved you one seat. It was difficult, but we did it.
Good evening, everyone. You can move closer if you like. There are plenty of seats. Thanks to everyone for coming out tonight. I know there's some pretty stiff competition, so we know that you're dedicated to this subject of data breach notification. Appreciate you being here. My name is David Sotola. I'm with the World Bank. Let me briefly introduce our panel. Who I also appreciate being here as opposed to Samba Knight. On my right is Demi Getchko from Brazil. We'll be giving a perspective on these issues from Brazil. To my immediate left is Rajneesh Singh from Fiji. He says we can call him Raj, so we'll do that. Also be giving the local perspective from Fiji and the Pacific Islands on these questions of data breach. Next is Hank Judy, who is here representing the American Bar Association, is also a partner in the law firm of Kilpatrick K&L Gates in Washington, D.C., and co-organized this panel with me. At my far left is Malcolm Harbour, who is a member of the European Parliament, who will be illuminating us on a recent development from the EU. So as to captivate the audience, I'll leave it at that, and Malcolm can surprise us with the information. The subject of tonight's best practice forum is data breach notification. As a best practice forum, this is a little bit different than workshops that you might have attended, insofar as it's not meant to be an advocacy session. It's meant to describe what current practices are, and perhaps next year at the IGF, we'll call them Current Practice Forum. So we've chosen the subject tonight, data breach notification, as really a subset of consumer protection issues, which we thought needed some illuminating at this forum. The way we're going to proceed in the next hour or so, we have an hour and a half, but I think given the panel and the time, we'll try and compress that as much as we can, is that Hank will introduce the topic, give a brief disposition of the issues, and then we'll hear reactions from Malcolm, Raj, and Demi. We'll then return to Hank, who will talk about remedies for data breach and what current practices are for those remedies. And again, we'll do a tour de table of the panelists to get their reactions, and then we'll open it up to questions. I should say that with a group as intimate as this one is, I think if you have questions at any time, it's probably okay to raise them, and I, as moderator, will take responsibility for managing the crowd. So for that, with that, I'll turn it over to Hank. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to try to do this standing up, and if that fails, I'll probably sit down. David has gone through the introduction, and what I'm going to now do is a brief outline. We're going to break this into some categories, the background, why this topic, and how this relates to our themes of security and access. Then I'm going to run through the basics, what I've referred to here as the who, what, where, when, and how, and then, as David indicated, we'll stop. We'll then go into comments, then into the remedies, and then another tour de table, tour d'horizon, and then we'll end. Why this topic? First, the incidence of data breaches and the compromise of consumer data is rising globally. There's a website in the United States that's run by the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse that runs an ongoing chronology of the records that have been breached in data breaches since January of 2005. This is the number of records, not the number of individuals who have had their records breached. But if you look at the total, which as of November 7, 2005, by their calculation, it's at 215,979,650. And considering that the U.S. has a population of roughly 300 million, that puts 70% of the records, or records regarding 70% of the population. You can, by clicking on to that link, you can get the running total as it adds. And I want to make the point that just because there's a breach in a jurisdiction, that is, the actual breach occurred in the United States, that doesn't mean that it doesn't compromise the identity of people in other jurisdictions. In fact, that is very often the case. Many jurisdictions are debating adding to their legislation in this area. In the reports and references part of these slides, which are at the end, are fairly comprehensive. You'll see that Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, as well as the EU, is working on legislation in this area. There's an extensive set of materials concerning the Canadian experience on the website that I've indicated there that's at the University of Ottawa. In the U.S., at least 35 states, current count, have laws dealing one way or another with data breach. The list as of January 9, 2000 is at the link there. That only covers 34. The 35th was added after that that particular collection was made. The other point that I think is relevant here is that simply because a specific law on this subject has not been adopted in a particular jurisdiction doesn't mean that there isn't exposure under common law and civil law for breach of contract or tort, And there are those who argue that the notice obligation is necessary, implied in many countries' data breach notification laws. Turning very specifically to the EU, individual member states have specific laws on the subject. For example, in Norway, there is mandatory reporting to the commissioner. And in different EU member states, Hungary, Malta, Sweden, and Germany, there are existing laws saying that the consumer has a right of to make an access request if they believe that they're in a class that's affected by a data breach, and the company has to respond within a relatively brief period of time. I note here in the last big bullet point on this slide that the EU is reviewing a regulatory framework for electronic communications, and there's a proposal to require data notification of security breaches, at least as it was presented by network operators and ISPs. It's limited in the proposal that was pending at the time I wrote this to the communication sector. Yesterday, the EU came out with a revision of its documents on this subject, and I'm not going to go into them now because Mr. Harbour is familiar with them, and I understand there's another gentleman in the audience here with the marvelously colorful tie who's also familiar with the matter, and so we can perhaps get some comments with him. So this is absolutely a current topic throughout the world. One of the key basics is what information is covered, and the obvious answer in the consumer protection contest is personal information. And I'm making that distinction because, let's say there's a data breach and trade secrets are taken. Well, that may become a securities law disclosure or a company's law disclosure, but it isn't really a consumer protection issue. A common approach in defining the covered PI is listed here in the second major bullet, which is borrowed largely from the seminal California statute on this subject. The individual's first name or first initial, last name, combination with various particular pieces of data, along with any kind of required security or access code to be able to make the data otherwise functional. Under U.S. law, as I say here, variations abound. You will find mother's maiden name, employer's assigned number, digitized or other electronic signatures, unique biometric data associated with a person, financial account numbers and credit cards, even without the access code. And you will sometimes find catch-all provisions that just say anything that would enable you to identify a natural person and could also be used to commit fraud or identity theft. So the issue of what exactly constitutes personal information is a key design issue. And you need to also make a decision in designing your law on this subject or deciding what are the best practices, whether you can cover only computerized data or paper too. Most specific U.S. laws deal only with electronic data. However, the EU Data Protection Directive, which arguably is implicated in this, covers paper records as well, as long as they're part of a system. Okay, your next design question is what exceptions? And U.S. law will often or generally will accept encrypted personal information. That, however, doesn't deal with the question of encrypted, how strong, exactly how long the key has to be, how good the algorithm has to be, and there's usually no specification on that subject. Many U.S. statutes will accept redacted personal information. That is, you start chopping letters off of credit card numbers as they're stored. You may also find a general statement, and the better laws, I think, are designed this way, that PI otherwise altered by any method to make it unreadable. That then also raises questions of, is it the key point that the data is unreadable, or is one of the possible design elements that the computer is locked in such a way that you really can't get at it? Say you had strong dual authentication. The argument around that is you can just take out the hard drive and have access to it that way. And there are also exceptions regularly for publicly available information that is not PI for these purposes, but you know, no definition of what constitutes the publicly information. Okay, what triggers the data breach notification? Well, a common definition is where the covered personal information was or is reasonably believed to have been acquired by an unauthorized person. That sounds very reasonable, except upon analysis, it starts to have some problems. What happens if you don't know whether it was acquired? Suppose it is simply accessed. Some statutes cover a, quote, acquisition that compromises the integrity of the PI. Well, if it's simply erased or corrupted, is that a triggering event? I've had to deal with a number of data breaches in my private practice in which this issue of exactly has the trigger occurred is the key question. And in this regard, the old rule that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, you simply do not know whether the hacker has been in there. One particular one I was talking to Rajneesh about, the hacker came in, obviously accessed the wrong kind of folder, however, was able to erase his tracks as he went, FTP'd the data if he accessed it to a series of sites. And by the time you finished doing the forensic on the thing, you hadn't the foggiest idea whether it was really the case that anyone was taken or not. From the technical point of view, this is probably the hardest issue with these statutes, and that is you cannot establish with confidence what happened, and you're dealing with a disclosure statute where you have to say something. The next issue is another major exception to the notice obligation, and I phrase this in terms of no notice obligation unless there's a reasonable reasonable likelihood of X. What's X? Well, substantial risk of identity theft or fraud, substantial harm, harm, inconvenience. What exactly has to happen in order for the notice obligation? It can be simply that there was a breach. Doesn't matter whether there was harm or not, and there are one or two statutes in the United States that are drafted that way. From a purely legislative point of view, this is the hardest issue. I'm distinguishing legislative versus technical. This particular issue is the reason why the U.S. Congress has been unable to adopt a federal statute on the subject. The interests are deadlocked on the subject. I do make reference here to a report by our U.S. Government Accountability Office, or GAO. It's the Congress's auditor for the federal government. This particular report did a survey of all of the breaches and then tried to link them causally to acts of identity theft. And what they found was that there was a substantial number of breaches, but relatively low number, quite a low number of incidents of identity theft that could be traced to the breaches. This was a very controversial report, but the numbers are the numbers. Okay, to whom, if you're designing your statute, to whom does the notice obligation apply? The owner, the controller in EU data protection terms, the processor in EU data protection terms, the licensee, the data broker, any person who is holding it, and so on. This is a tricky issue because exactly who is the owner and who's the licensee is often not a very clear legal question, and you have instances in which the person who is the owner attempts by contract to impose the notice obligation on the licensee. and you have the controller attempting to impose the notice obligation on the processor, and so on. So you have these issues of what's the priority, what are the liabilities inter se among the particular parties, and this ties, I want to just flag this to a jurisdiction issue that I'm going to raise. Okay, to whom, here's your next design issue, to whom does the notice have to be given, or must it be given, should it be given, may it be given? The various possibilities are the individual, the regulator, the law enforcement authority, credit reporting agencies, the card issuer, some combination, and a required sequence. Under some U.S. laws, there is a required sequence. You have to tell the law enforcement agency first, and then you notify the individuals only if the law enforcement agency tells you to or allows you to. It is normally the case, if credit card data is taken, at least under U.S., you are obligated as a matter of contract to give notification to the credit card issuer. So depending on the exact nature of the breach, you can wind up with a set of questions over to whom the notice is given. Okay, let's suppose you've concluded you have to, then what form should this take? One is just simply a mailed notice to the individual, and under California law, I note this is the default. You probably, in designing your statute, should have a default. Email, is that permissible? Telephone, at least 3 states in the United States permit it to be done by telephone. 1 state permits it to be done by fax. Can you do public notice via media? California sets it up in such a way that once the cost of the notification exceeds a certain level, then you can give notice by way of media. Another interesting development is giving notice by website and then combining that with an email notification or something of that nature. There was one, I went to Georgetown University, Georgetown Law, and I was interested to see that the university put up a website in which it admitted as a contractor it lost the data on 10,000 elderly citizens of the District of Columbia, and it put up a website and explained the entire thing and sent emails to everybody that was involved in mail, and they used, in a very clever way, the website as a means of handling updates. As new information came in, they kept revising the website, which is a particularly good technique. There is one issue I wanted to mention here. I didn't want to put it in the slides. In the U.S., we have found, as a matter of practice, if you give really extensive notification, it is sometimes the case that the fraudsters then come out and contact the people who have been notified, and the fraudsters offer to, quote, help them rectify their credit problems, which is just another way of them spamming the people who and otherwise abusing the people who have gotten the notice. That happened famously when the Boston Globe, a Boston newspaper, had a significant data breach. Okay, so we've gotten this far, and our next issue is, what does the notice have to say, or should it say, or may it say? And I've listed here, in the form of questions, the kinds of things that, this is just a complete catalog of ships, of all of the various things that different U.S. laws have either required or by guidelines encouraged that the notice say. And just backing up for one moment, what happened, what was involved, how do you protect yourself, what are we going to do to assist you, how do you contact credit reporting agencies, what else can you do to protect yourself, particularly can you put in a data freeze. A security freeze on your credit files. And some 39 states in the District of Columbia in the U.S. have laws specifically giving the consumer the right to have credit freezes put on their accounts at little or no cost under these circumstances. Do you have a right to receive a police report? New Jersey law says yes. Contact information at relevant agencies and the like. Okay, now you've gotten this far in your design. Now you have to decide how soon does the notice have to be given. Some statutes put in a duty of prompt investigation. Other statutes say the notice has to occur in a fixed period of time. Some say as soon as practicable. And then there's the California rule that I've cited here. That is, the disclosure has to be made in the most expedient time possible, that unreasonable delay, consistent with the needs of law enforcement, and any measures necessary to determine the scope of the breach, a sort of investigative exception. Some states also will prohibit you from giving the notice unless the law enforcement authorities, having been notified, tell you to do so, or they ask you to hold off. The final point that I want to make under this basics is this issue of jurisdiction. And this is a particular problem in the U.S., where you have so many jurisdictions, and that is, how does it work across border? In a federal system, or actually this also works whenever you have nation states that are close to one another and data is in multiple jurisdictions. And I pose the particular question, suppose the breach occurs in a server in your foreign subsidiary, or because the laptop goes missing in some foreign jurisdiction. A particular issue is the one that's fourth down, and that is, can jurisdiction A, in this case, California, require entities in jurisdictions B, C, and D to give notice to residents of jurisdiction A when the compromised data was held by citizens of B or C or D? In this case, the covered entity be doing business or have some level of contacts with jurisdiction A, or is it simply enough that the personal information was the personal information of a citizen of A? I have no idea how this is going to be handled in the EU, but but it is necessarily an issue in the EU. There is an issue under U.S. federalism. I don't know how it would work in other jurisdictions, but does national law preempt the subnational law, that is, provincial law or state law? U.S. law does permit circumstances in which there's a reverse preemption, that is, that the national law preempts the state law, except to the extent that the state law may be more permissive, may be more protective, in which case it's possible that the state law will preempt the federal law. So you have these issues of the integration of federal and sub-federal laws that are necessarily presented with these kinds of cases. So this is the lawyer's way of looking at all of this. This is the lawyer's lens. And with this on the table, let me throw it open to David. And if you will.
Thanks, Hank. Before we move on from the basic introduction, I wanted to offer the audience a chance to ask questions on this much of it so far before we move on to hear what's happening in the EU from Mr. Harbour. Excellent. Okay, the exam will be in half an hour. There are no questions. Malcolm, I'd like to turn to you now, and if you could give a brief overview of what's just happened in the EU. This was intended to be a best practice forum. It's clearly an evolving practice forum because there's new practice that's just come out from the EU. And Malcolm, if you could tell us about that, please.
Well, it's certainly, is this working? Is this one working? Or would you rather?
No.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Yes, well, I mean, this certainly is evolving practice, and this really couldn't be more timely, because actually I think that the European Commission officials who drafted this proposal, and just so that everybody understands where we are with this as far as the European legal process is concerned, that the Commission has issued a draft proposal which now goes to the two other institutions, the lawmaking institutions, the European Parliament, and also the Council of Ministers, in other words, the Member States, who will assemble a specialist committee to work on it. And in fact, the lead British civil servant who's on that committee is here as well. So they will start going through it line by line. And the context is that this is part of a reform package which is making some selective adjustments to the existing communications framework legislation that's been in operation in the European Union since 2002. And that framework legislation provides a common framework of law across the European Union, but which is then implemented in the member states, in member states' national legislation, and also is implemented by the national regulatory authorities for the supplying of communication services in across the EU countries, and they have to be established under a common framework. Now, as far as the data processing element of this is concerned and data breach, this legislation specifically applies to data protection in electronic communications. It doesn't actually reform the generic law on data protection, and so therefore it doesn't include paper copies or anything else. Now, that's something that may well come later, but essentially the Commission has moved under the terms of its existing remit to add this as an amendment to the existing legislation. And therefore, the wording of it is quite interesting, particularly in relation to some of the detail that we've seen here, because the first point I want to make is that a lot of the detail provisions are not included in here because they're actually left to a sort of committee, an implementing committee structure, which will decide on a lot of the detailed points that Henk Judy raised in his extremely comprehensive presentation. But I think for me, the most interesting issues, and of course I've only just seen this, and we will be responding to this in the European Parliament, where we have the right, by the way, to amend any of these pieces of legislation and completely redraft it should we choose to do so, that we're talking about accidental or unlawful destruction, loss, alteration, unauthorized disclosure or access to personal data, which I think covers most of your bases. I think that was pretty consistent. But it's personal data transmitted, stored, or otherwise processed in connection with the provision of a publicly available communications service. So it's linked to that, and it's actually the provider of the service that has to, and this is the phrase, without undue delay, notify the subscriber concerned, and also the national regulatory authority. Remember what I said earlier. In other words, the national regulatory authorities will also be involved in some sort of coordinating and policing role. The notification to the subscriber shall at least describe the nature of the breach and recommended measures to mitigate its possible negative effects. And there's a supplementary requirement to notify the regulatory authorities of the consequences of and the measures taken to address the breach by the provider. So that's it, basically. And the recitals or the preamble to the legislation do indicate some of the issues that you raised in your presentation about what the timescale should be, in what form it should take, who it should be addressed to, and so on. But that's the core of it. So whether it will become best practice or not may well depend, one, on how the Parliament responds, and two, I think, on whether we invite you to come over to Brussels to give this presentation to the people concerned, because I think you've added so much extra to this that this may well be a rather seminal event in deciding whether Europe can get this law right or not.
Just to clarify, it would not apply to a retailer. If Harrods lost 1,000
yes.
No, card numbers, it wouldn't apply to that.
Well, no, but I think only to the extent that the Harrods data is on a publicly available website or is lost by a processor of a publicly available data service, then it clearly would be. And I think this has been particularly aimed at issues where people have got through defensive mechanisms and found, for example, that when they've logged on and paid for something with a credit card, they've found that they've had access to everybody else's data records. So, for example, if Harrods had a website and people undertook a transaction on the Harrods website and there was a breach of security there, then it would apply to them. But actually, it would be the provider of the service that would have to do the notification and not Harrods themselves. But, I mean, that's something that we may want to look at in terms of whether there is a joint liability. So the owner of the data may well need to be included in this. So I think that's an important point. One point I didn't pick up, actually, but you asked me about jurisdictional issues. I have to say this paragraph here is not very clear on jurisdictional issues, but clearly I think it's implicit, bearing in mind that this will apply across all the 27 members of the European Union, that if the data is held in one country which applies to a subscriber in the other, there will be a requirement to deal with that on a cross-border basis, because every member state will need to implement this in their own national legislation, and they may choose to do it in different ways, but the intent is that a consumer will have the same rights if his data is breached in any country.
Thank you, Malcolm. Any questions at this point before we move on to the reactions from Demi and Raj? Okay.
Just a small clarification. So the data must be on a publicly accessible network, correct?
Yes, I mean, I just emphasize, I saw this yesterday for the first time.
Yeah, sure.
And by the way, I have one memory stick for any enthusiasts, first come, first serve, which has the complete set of information on. So
if an organization, a company, were running a private network, there would not be, this law would not apply to them, correct?
My understanding is that it wouldn't, because it's the provider of a publicly available electronic communication service.
So public, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Demi, let me turn to you first and get your reactions from the Brazilian perspective on the material that Hank has laid out for us, and if you have any comments about what you've heard from Malcolm as well. Thanks.
Thank you, David. As a matter of fact, I feel myself more comfortable to be in the audience maybe than in the panel, because I'm not from the judicial area. I'm not a lawyer or not involved with this. But anyway, I found this material very interesting. It's a very comprehensive presentation we are having today. And, of course, the scenario in Brazil, like other development and countries, is not diverse from what we saw in other places. We have a black market for data, for personal data, for a lot of information that we don't want to see in inappropriate hands. And of course, there are laws to prohibit or to go against these acts, but this is not really related to the internet itself. Then going back to the point you raised, we are trying to develop some best practices information or some best practices steering manuals or so forth, the providers. And this is more devoted to what kind of data they could or they couldn't disclosure. And also we are very emphatic in saying that they have to have a statement for the users claiming what they will be doing with the users' data, not to leave them free to negotiate or to sell this kind of data to other providers or other institutions. Of course, we don't have even the optimum scenario when all the people behave in the correct way, and the steering committee has no tools to go against, but we can inform and can educate the people maybe to behave in a better way. I suppose also without being even near an expert in laws, the common law in U.S. is quite different from the law in the Roman system of law in Brazil. But normally, what is crime in U.S. is also is crime also in Brazil, and we are aware of this kind of breaches. One question I have to the panel that's more related to internet issues. It's more related maybe to Huawei. And I take the opportunity to explain more or less what we are trying to do in Brazil. We understand that certain kinds of information has to be disclosed for the benefit or for the security of the community as a whole. For example, if we have an enterprise doing business on the internet and this enterprise holds a domain name or holds a set of IP numbers, we think it is reasonable to display the data that identifies this enterprise to the customers, because maybe the customers have some trouble or have to be in contact with the responsible for the site. We try to limit the access to this kind of data, but several ways using weird captchas or limiting the number of access per IP number or per time. But anyway, this data is open to consultation. And for natural persons, we have another approach that is much more restrictive. But even in this case, we display the name and one kind of unique identifier to make this name unique in the spectrum of the customers of the domain system. We think this is also a way to protect the other users for impersonification of customers of domains of having sites that causes harm to the public in general, and it's good for one customer to can prove that he is not the owner of that kind of site of information. Then this is a question, because I saw in the material that the trying to define what is personal information. And I suppose one set of the personal information is kind of public information, and it's available to the whole community. And I want to hear from the panel what is the threshold, where we put the boundary of what is really private and what could be disclosed.
Thank you, Demi. Raj, I'll turn to you, and then we can address Demi's question. Raj.
Thank you. Before this session started, Hank and I had a little chat, and what I said to him was that I knew that consumer protection and data breach notification was an issue, but I never really appreciated the extent of the problems until he sent me a whole bunch of literature over the last couple of weeks in relation to this session here today. After I went through that literature and did a bit of research myself, and I realized that for my part of the region, which is best described as a developing region, all I can say, this is a disaster waiting to happen. Because, you know, we're a region, we are part of that next 1 billion that we want to get online. And there's this huge emphasis on getting people connected. But at the same time, those people who are getting connected are also perhaps the most vulnerable who will be getting connected. So I worry, and you know, just over the last couple of weeks, that I'm getting more and more worried on what will actually happen when we do get everyone online. I don't know if you attended any of the Access workshops here, but we presented a few on the Pacific Islands and what Access initiatives are going to happen there. And you know, all those programs will enable people to be connected. It will hasten e-commerce as one. Now, I know in the Pacific, e-commerce is becoming a buzzword. People want to be e-enabled. They want to put their products online. However, the systems they run are pretty primitive by European or US standards. I mean, for instance, I know a colleague of mine runs a website where he gives his staff access to certain data for his company through the internet. He does not use SSL. It's a simple port 80, so you go to http://whatever his website address is. There's no encryption whatsoever. And that access that he gives to his staff actually includes a lot of customer information, because it's a business he runs, and he's giving them access to part of his database. So, I mean, there's an education process that is required, yes, but I worry what the ramifications could be, because although we have consumer protection laws, they, again, are somewhat basic, and they don't really cover all these new technologies. They are, you know, a remnant in most cases in the Pacific of the British system, which was left with us when we became independent. So, and those laws are pretty basic compared to what technology exists today. I mean, I don't really have an answer of how we're going to solve this. And the biggest problem is the governments and policymakers are too busy in more priority issues to be able to spend time on this issue. And then I go back to what I said earlier, that if they don't address this issue now, when the countries and the people come online, you know, what you will have is the Pacific being fleeced left, right, and center. Now, we've already been fleeced in the past, and this is just a whole new wave of fleecing that will happen. A couple other quick comments I'd like to make. In the Pacific, we have a culture of shared communities, which means in a typical household, you know, you'll have the father, you'll have the mother, you'll have the kids, you may also have the cousins and the aunts and the aunties. So it's communal living. It's not a nuclear family that lives together. It's a community that lives together. Now, part of that culture also says that, you know, what is mine is yours and what is yours is mine. And the simplest example is ATM key cards. You know, you go to an ATM machine to withdraw money. In a typical household, everyone would know everyone else's PIN number for an ATM card. So that makes the problem even worse, because the culture does not accept that someone can steal my information and withdraw my money. Of course, it happens, but it's assumed it will not happen because it's family. It's what you call the Matangali in Fiji. It's a community. So again, that is an issue that needs to be balanced in the cultural context. And what happens if something does go wrong? I mean, who do you blame? Where does the blame start? Where does the blame stop? And how can the government enact legislation when the culture is perhaps headed in the different direction? Other things that come to mind is the cost of protection. Obviously, the Pacific or developing regions are small commercial markets, particularly in smaller countries. To implement systems to protect the data, well, that's going to be pretty expensive, and I do not know whether all companies would be able to sustain the costs. There was mention of email notification as a means of notification. You know, email's been great to alleviate communications issues, but these days I really have very little faith in email, simply because the spam filtering used by most people is getting more and more aggressive. You don't really know if the message actually got delivered or not. So using email as a form of notification, I don't think, I mean, honestly, putting on my engineering hat, I think it'd be a waste of time. I mean, it just does not make sense. And I'll give you a perfect example. I come from the private sector. About 2 months ago, I was on the verge of closing a very large transaction. That transaction was completely being transacted using the internet, through email, basically. I sent an email. I don't want to get into details, but I sent an email which basically accepted an offer. That email never reached the person that email was intended to get to. It just so happens, I know the guy pretty well, so I called him up and said, I haven't heard back from you. What happened? He said, well, I never heard from you, so I haven't done anything about it. And then when I said, but hey, I emailed you, and this is the date stamp, this is the time stamp, and you know, it left my mail server. It should have gone to your mail server. And yes, it did hit his mail server, but there was a particular word in the email I sent him which got flagged as spam, and it went into the spam filter, and it never got to him. Of course, we transacted the deal a day later. But the fact is, if I had not called him, if I did not know him that well enough to be able to call him, we would have lost that large transaction. So email notification, no, I don't think that's a really good idea. The other one was website. That, of course, assumes that people have access to that website. So, again, that's an issue that could arise. One very other quick one. I'm sorry, I'm hogging time here, but there was mention of credit bureaus and how you notify them. In Fiji, we have credit bureaus which are operated by third parties where companies subscribe to them. So there is no specific legislation that I'm aware of that actually covers these credit bureaus. It exists as a thing to the side. And companies who are interested in protecting their debtors and or collecting on their debtors subscribe to them. So in this instance, I don't know how you could enforce these credit bureaus to accept the fact that data has been stolen and there could be fraud and such things happening. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thanks, Raj. Do either of you want to respond to Demi's question?
I will if you. Yeah. As I understand, I think this is. As I understand Demi's question, he's really asking, what are the boundaries of what is public data,
yes,
what is private data, and as was indicated in one of the earlier bullet points, that is a completely uncertain proposition under the laws that I'm familiar with. It simply isn't defined. However, there are laws in other jurisdictions that attempt to deal with it in a functional way. That is, they say, if the data is data of the kind that is likely or susceptible or especially susceptible to abuse for purposes of identity theft or other fraud, then it's covered data and the issue of whether it's public or private drops out of the question. So it becomes a functional test rather than the legal test of whether it's public or private. That's the only comment I have on that.
I just wanted to comment on this issue about email as a form of notification, because I think that if your data has already been compromised, then there's the potential if you send someone email by return, you merely make the data breach worse, because potentially whoever spammed it will also collect your email address as well. And I pick up Hank's point earlier on about that there are cases. I mean, certainly not necessarily concerned with data breach, but people have had credit cards stolen, and then the thief has then rung the person concerned, posing to be their credit card company, to tell them about it and to get their PIN code. So this is actually a much more complex issue, and I think you've done extremely well here to raise the complexity of it. Just a final point of observation, though, because you were talking about the legal framework in Fiji as far as consumer protection is concerned and how it needs to move forward. I mean, I would say one of the things that I think we've now learned, and that this was a big battle at a European level in the first review of this legislation in 2001, 2002, was to move for the first time to a regime for email, and particularly for sort of marketing emails, where consumers have to opt in to have it. And it's not a default option to opt out of it. And that was quite controversial at the time, because the US has gone in an entirely different direction. But actually, I think that this has been extremely popular, even though, of course, it can be circumvented by mail coming in from outside the European Union. But generally, I think that consumers across Europe feel that we made the right decision to go for an opt-in regime.
I'd love to make just a couple of comments very quickly, because I don't want to keep everyone away from the drink. But it may be worth saying, because I was on Merlin Errol, Lord Errol, I'm a member of the House of Lords, crossbench independent, and I was on the Lords Science and Technology Committee, which did a big report into personal internet safety, which you can find on the internet if you want to. This whole data breach, one of the things that became very apparent was that no one knew the scale of the problem. We knew there was a lot of stuff setting out there on Russian websites that could be accessed and bought very cheaply. We knew that companies were losing data quite regularly and not telling anyone and hiding it and sweeping it under the carpet. We were concerned by the fact the banks then were setting up a fraud reporting unit where the default situation was going to be, even recommended by the police, that stuff would be reported to this APACS lot first, and they would then decide whether they reported it to the police or the Serious and Organized Crime Agency. And it was going to be very hard to get a grip on it. So we suggested that we should have a data breach notification law, and we just said it in simple terms. We didn't do any of the details on it, but the principal things were that it was in order to try and get a sense of the scale of the problem. We didn't go into how it should be reported because we knew there were problems with it, or who it should be reported to, should people be informed. Though we did feel that the citizen had a right to know that their accounts and their money was at risk, was a general feeling, so they should be informed in some way. And it wasn't the company's right to keep it secret in order to inspire confidence. If the government, we also felt that the data was unusable in the form that it was found, in other words, it was properly encrypted, then that wasn't a data breach, because no data had leaked out that was usable. And that's about where we left it. Looking at these problems, one begins to realize it was just as well we did it that way. And I'd love to get a copy of the slides of it. It would be very useful to use in debate, actually, because I will be debating it quite soon in the Lords, just to mention a few things. The only thing I would say, which is this whole thing about email and them, the problems of them emailing out to warn you, it all becomes because everyone's thinking about authentication one way around. And at the moment, you authenticate yourself to your bank or your credit card. Sometimes, because they're so worried about who you are, they give you a token, so it's two-factor authentication. They don't authenticate themselves back to you. That's wrong. And I've been in my bonnet about this, as does Fred Piper at Royal Holloway and people like that. Authentication is a two-way issue. And if we had two-way authentication, you would then know that emails actually came from the people that you thought they came from, and you'd be able to verify it. There's plenty of technology out there that can do this very simply. Companies like TriCypher can do it even without having to have a two-channel authentication. And you can do it by split keys in various ways. And we need to get that in there. And in fact, we also recommended that the banks should be liable for all card not present. We have a problem in the UK where the banks shift off liability onto the merchants if it's done over the telephone. It's called card not present. I don't know if you have this in other countries. And we reckoned that it was unfair that merchants were having to take responsibility for accepting a token which was not secure enough to protect them, which was issued by the banks who unloaded the liability onto them. So one of the other things we recommend was the banks should get the liability back. They might then do better security, and in doing that, we might get two-way authorization as well. And then it would solve a lot of the problems, because you then could do email notification. And I think that's probably I better finish my bees in my bonnet about there, or we won't get any supper.
Thank you very much for that contribution. It was most helpful to the debate. I wanted to exercise moderator's discretion and say that this question of dispatch and receipt is a question that's been wrestled with a lot, and most recently at the international level through a treaty that was promulgated and then by UNCITRAL and then adopted by the UN General Assembly on electronic contracting, cross-border electronic contracts. But it's interesting that this very elementary question dealing with e-commerce issues over the internet is one of the bugaboos that we have to deal with in this very rarefied question of data breach notification. I'd like now to turn to the second portion of the program, which deals with the remedies, and turn the floor back to Hank to go through that.
Let me, before I do that, make just a couple comments on the things that have just been said. First, Rajneesh raised the issue of encryption and mentioned that the data wasn't even encrypted in transmission. The issue of whether these various statutes that I'm referring to refer to data encrypted in storage or encrypted in transmission, or both, is again one of those open issues. The House of Lords report that was just referred to, which by the way is a superb piece of work, in my
although I'm not a subject of the Queen, it's a superb piece of work. And in the references and in the back of these slides, there's a link to it, and you can download it from the appropriate website. This issue of encryption in storage and encryption in transmission is referred to, but what I found interesting in it was it assumed that it was encryption in storage. It's phrased in such a way that it seems to exclude from consideration encryption in transmission. Let me stop there, and let's go on to remedies. We're now at the stage in our process that the data breach notification has been given. Okay, what follows from that, and who would enforce whatever the law happens to say, and the usual suspects are the national government, a functional or specialized regulator, the state or provincial government. Are fines available? If so, what? And in that connection, and there really should be a bullet in there that distinguishes between fines for the fact that you had the breach and fines for the fact that you gave the notice improperly or didn't give the notice. There's a distinction as to what exactly the fine is for. One of the most difficult issues, at least under U.S. law, is this question of whether there's a private right of action in the hands of the in the hands of the user. Private right of action is a common law term. I don't know whether it's used in civil law. It's usually referred to as jus tertii, the law of the third person in civil law, and it has to be specifically granted under some civil law systems. But if so, if there is a private right of action, in whom is it? Is it in the user? Do they proceed by way of contract? Do they proceed by way of tort? That is a negligence. Do they have a right to proceed by both? Are class actions permitted? And if there's damage, you know, what is the measure of damage, and what exactly do you get damages for? I will be going into these in a moment, but I just wanted to put the questions out. The main point I want to make with these slides, this and a few following ones, is that no matter what you do, as soon as you start talking about data breach notification, you immediately raise the question of what are the information security standards. Has anybody breached a duty, you have to know what the duty is, and how high is the bar? Is it this high or that high? So there has to be some definition of what they constitute. I wanted to bring to your attention that an important standard in this regard, at least in the U.S., and to the extent that these standards apply outside the U.S., they're also valuable there, and that is the data security standards of the Payment Card Industry Association, or PCI-DSS. These have gone through actually a couple evolution or an evolution. They came in a while back. This link will take you to the current version. And what they require is that all merchants, that is anybody who's accepting credit card payments, to implement this, their standard requirements that are scaled, that is they're keyed to the amount of your annual transaction volume. And they get harder as your transaction volume increases. And built into these standards is an obligation. You can go on and look at it and look under what to do if compromised, and it will talk about that. This is a general summary of what are the consequences if the issuing association, the Visa Card Association, MasterCard Association, determines that an entity has been deficient or negligent in reporting or investigating the breach, then they can fine the merchant or its agent, impose restrictions, and they can even permanently prohibit the merchant or the agent from participating in its programs. So if there's been a data breach and it involves credit card information, you need to look at these standards because they are particularly severe. Okay, if these aren't the standards, what standards might otherwise apply? And let's see, we skipped ahead here. I think some data is missing here. I'm sorry, this may be a slightly older version. There's a version in which I listed alternatives, security law standards, and I'm sorry, but I just have a slightly older version of this. What I next want to shift to is some litigation cases in the United States that raise a lot of the litigation issues that are triggered by data breach notification. For example, in this now older case from 2005, Bell, what happened was a union promised its members that it would keep their personal data secure on a server that was run by the union. The union did not keep that promise. The data was released. The union members suffered damage. The union members sued the union, which is a fairly unusual event, and they recovered. These FTC cases, the FTC is our Federal Trade Commission, and these are cases that they brought against people fining them for not imposing longer-term plans on them for failure to adhere to data breach notification standards. The two more recent cases, one of them, this Kayla case, actually our firm represented, some interesting questions arose here. What basically happened is some thieves went to the offices of a data processor. They went into the street. They pulled up a manhole cover, a thing of great weight, tossed it through windows, smashed their way into a secure data facility. They took the blade servers that were within this data center and left. And people whose data were stored on these servers then sued Litton on the grounds that Litton did not adequately protect their data, and as a result of that, they suffered damage in that they had to go to credit card issuers and they had to go to credit reporting agencies and go through a somewhat expensive drill changing their data, changing their cards, and they wanted to be compensated for that. And the court held in this particular case that there was no breach of duty, that they had adequately secured the facility, and the fact that somebody smashed, grabbed, broke through, and that kind of thing was not a breach of their duty. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead and bring your attention to what is what I've referred to as the mother of all cases in this area, the so-called TJX case. This is a very, very, very large U.S. retailer headquartered in Massachusetts, has some 2,500 stores. They disclosed a data breach. It had actually turned out that the thieves had broken into it some 2 years earlier and had spent much of 2 years milking TJX's databases, and TJX disclosed in filings with the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission, the equivalent of the Financial Services Authority in the U.K., that some 45 million credit cards and debit card numbers had been stolen. This is the largest single data breach anywhere on the planet. there's been a suit against TJS, putting aside the consumer suits, by multiple financial institutions, and they're seeking class action status. The reason why the banks are suing TJX is they want their costs recovered for the fact that they had to go through and change all of the credit card numbers and so on. Their filings indicate that TJX doesn't know what it's talking about, that actually 94 million separate credit card accounts were compromised in the process. There have been lawsuits and investigations by the FTC, the Attorney General of several states. The Canadian Privacy Commissioner has done a report on the matter because a large number of the credit card accounts were of Canadian citizens. It was a very, very critical report, and there's been a proposed settlement of the consumer class action, which included a credit card and ID monitoring services and various forms of reimbursement that the members of the that the protected class would receive. So there is so much material on the web about the TJX case that I didn't. It's sometimes also referred to as the TJ Maxx case because TJ Maxx is the largest of the various subsidiary retailers. TJX is the holding company name. If you just go on Google or Ask or whatever your search engine is and put in TJX, you'll get more than you can possibly read. I want to just mention the kinds of things that are in the reports and references here. The Australian Law Reform Commission put out a report, some 2,000 pages, on reforming their privacy laws, which are in many ways very similar to the EU Data Protection Directive. In fact, any data processed under Australian law is considered to be adequately processed as a matter of the EU. There is a chapter 47 in that 2,000 pages. It's a very, very good analysis of data protection laws around the world, and it makes a recommendation that Australia adopt a data protection law. If you go to the New Zealand Privacy Commissioner's website, you'll find a lot of material on it. The California Office of Privacy Protection, which is an infamously aggressive office in our states, has a very nice recommended practices on data breach notification. There's a white paper that was issued by the University of Ottawa, which is extremely informative on these questions. There was a Canadian parliamentary review of Canadian data protection practices, which is cited here. This was not well received by government. It's sort of the same kind of recommendation that I understand the home or review or response that the Home Secretary gave to the House of Lords report. So you can take some comfort in the fact that the former colony is behaving just like the parent. Then their trustee, which I'm sure people who practice in the privacy area are familiar with trustee, they have an extensive checklist on data notification practices. As I mentioned in the main slides, under our Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which is a law that regulates financial institutions in the U.S., there is a general requirement for data breach notification, and it's sector-specific to the financial institution area. It's a very good piece of work. Then I've listed two comments, one of our FTC and one of the Software Information Industry Association on the proposed EU framework. They take opposite positions, but they're well reasoned. This is the cite to the House of Lords report, and this is the cite to the GAO report that I gave.
And if you really want to know what the granddaddy statute says, the California data breach law, there's the site to it on the website of the California legislature. So if you're really interested in digging into the issues, all of this should keep you very busy. That covers more or less what we wanted to put on the table for further discussion.
Thank you, Hank. We will either through the IGF online blog site or through the IntGov forum site, the official site of the IGF secretariat, find a way to post this presentation to make it a bit easier to connect to the links. We're in discussion with the secretariat about that right now. We can post reports to it, to the website. We can post documents. I don't know whether we can post attachments yet, so we're working on that. Before we open up to questions, I wanted to give the panel a chance to react to this portion of the presentation, and in reverse order, we'll start with you, Raj.
This particular set of material has been quite interesting to me, and it raised a question for me personally. Part of our business activities is actually outsourcing, and we outsource to firms in the US, in Europe, and so on. Now, as most of you are aware, developing countries are countries of opportunities for the BPO industry, business process outsourcing. So the question that comes to mind is, and perhaps Hank, you could answer this for me, I know of a lot of firms which outsource processes which actually includes a lot of private data. So what happens there? Because this is data which is being processed in a foreign country which may not actually have any consumer protection or data breach laws, which may not have any agreements with, let's say, the US. So what happens there?
Well, the usual answer is that this kind of thing should be covered in the outsourcing contract. That is, the outsourcer sends the data to the outsourcee, and in the contract it says, if there's a breach, here are the responsibilities of the vendor. My experience with this is that this is a sufficiently new area that is often just not in the contract. So you're left with general law principles, and I think the way most U.S. laws would work is that whoever is considered in some sense the controller of the data, or I think, and I stand subject to correction on this, under EU law, the responsibility would lie on whoever is designated as the controller. So they would then have the obligation. Now, whether the controller or the owner would then be amenable to the jurisdiction of the agencies that's trying to impose the notification obligation on it is open to question. Now, if you're processing data from jurisdiction A in your jurisdiction B, and jurisdiction A says that A has to give it, can A then impose the obligation on you, you know, in any sense outside of a contract? I simply don't know. It would depend on the facts. It's one of the problems in this area, is that the cross-jurisdictional issues haven't been worked out in the absence of a federal system or in the absence of a system like the EU, where the member states are under obligations to enforce one another's laws. But once you get out of that kind of system, unless there's a contract, it's completely unclear.
I mean, given the amount of data that's being processed in, say, India, say, but other areas, I mean, we will face similar issues.
My only observation is that I learned much more than I could contribute it for this panel, but it's really a very interesting issue, and we'll try to collaborate in this area also here in Brazil.
We have a few minutes for questions. Yep, we have one in the audience. Just shout. I'm sorry, they want you to do the mic, so if you can come up.
Thank you. I won't repeat myself, though. Just to reintroduce, I'm Brad Biddle from Intel Corporation. My question, sort of observation, is that I think for companies like Intel who have many databases that contain records about people from all over the world, a challenge we face is, you know, we recognize the appropriateness and the need for breach notification laws, and then we just face a very complex compliance environment where you know, if you know any particular database is compromised, the question of, you know, what laws apply and, you know, what practices do we follow. You very nicely highlighted the wide range of questions, and perhaps different jurisdictions around the world end up answering those questions differently. And so we've already faced this in the U.S. with different state standards, and I think that challenge is going to get, you know, even harder for us as we face, you know, a global environment where there are, you know, very different or potentially very different rules applicable in this area. So my question is, maybe one more observation is that I think this forum is a good step towards, you know, what I hope would be some eventual convergence on some kind of global sort of set of standards, but I think I just went out. No, my question is: do you sense, are we trending towards that at this point, or trending away from that at this point? And if we're trending towards it, which is my hope, do you have any sense of what sort of time frame before we see some kind of global consensus on how to answer the questions that you've laid out?
Well, let me just make a few comments and then throw it open to the other panelists. I have the following kinds of reactions. First, I think it's going to take quite a while. The EU doesn't move with the speed of light here. It's going to take a while for it to have even something that's harmonized on the EU level. Then the transposition into national law is going to take a while. There's going to be any number of debates there. I think you see a recommendation for it both in New Zealand and in Canada and in Australia, but you see some resistance from government. And I think what's going to have to happen is that there's going to have to be more horrible cases. And given the state of security around the globe and given the fact that in particularly in many areas in Asia, the systems are inherently insecure, then you're going to have those kinds of incidents. Let me defend the proposition that they're inherently insecure. In many jurisdictions, much of the software is pirated. If it is pirated, it can't be patched. If it can't be patched, it's insecure. And if you start transmitting personal data over those kinds of systems, or you start depending upon those kind of systems for the security of the personal data, it's only a matter of time before the failures accumulate, and as Rajneesh was saying, as the next billion come on board and the next billion want to use e-banking and e-commerce and have all of the advantages of it, there's a collision is kind of occurring. So I think this is one of those inevitable issues, but it's going to have to get worse before it gets better. And I think you're talking about a multi-year process, and the only thing that you can do is just keep the issue before bodies like this and keep pushing. And ultimately, it will have to be resolved. I think, if only because the public isn't going to put up with it. You know, they're not going to be put up with being kept in ignorance. And also, it seems to me that one of the justifications for these kinds of data breach notification regimes is that they actually force the companies to increase the level of their security. It becomes an incentive. And that's one of the public policy justifications for doing it. I don't know whether that answers your question, but that's my own thinking on the subject.
Well, I think your last point is the most important one, is that having this in place is going to force, I think, companies to be much more careful about how they handle people's personal data. I think it's interesting to look at some of the remedies and issues around this, but, I mean, effectively, if a data breach occurs, it's going to be immensely damaging to the reputation of the company concerned, and they will have probably financial losses from civil lawsuits in any case. I mean, how far there will be a global standard? I mean, I'm not sure that that's a particularly relevant question to ask, frankly, because everybody has to operate in their own operating jurisdictions anyway. I mean, we're not going to have any more than we're going to have a sort of common operating law in the United States and in Europe. I mean, in Europe, we will have something close to that across the 27 member states, but we'll certainly have a different regime for the United States.
Just a couple quick observations, and we'll move to the next question. If you look at the... wrap up in a couple of minutes. The Wiggig report, produced by a prior iteration of this, identified privacy as one of the areas that was completely lacking at the international stage and that was done on a case-by-case, country-by-country basis. What we've seen previously in privacy was an accord of sorts between the EU and the US with a safe harbor agreement. So we might get things like that, which are sort of patchwork approaches to things. But it's clearly an area that doesn't lend itself neatly to global responses. We had a question here, and for our UK friends, if they have to make an exit.
I've got to be down to what we're doing next.
Fine. Okay. Can we give Malcolm a round of applause first while he... Thanks. Okay.
This is the one copy of the EU, so first come, first served.
Right.
Thanks again.
Sorry. Thank you. Just in time. Well, my name is Gisele Santa Rosa. I'm a lawyer here in Brazil. And I'm also a chairman of the Information Technology Committee of the Brazilian Association of Intellectual Property. So I just want to make a quick comment about how this, and I really want to thank you guys all for the presentation, because it's very difficult for us here in Brazil to have presentations in such depth when it comes to privacy and data breach matters, because as I'm going to mention in my comment, our law here is still not yet very evolved when it comes to these issues. And within my comment, I would like to actually make a question, but I'm assuming you can answer it from the U.S. perspective. I'm sorry that our friends from England left, but I would also love, love to hear their perspective as well on this matter. And I just want to make a very brief comment about how privacy law works here. And first of all, it's privacy here is actually, privacy laws here in Brazil are actually very broad. We just have one specific point in the Brazilian Constitution, it's Article 5, that say that you have to, private information of anyone should be protected. And on the other hand, we also have a very broad consumer protection law in which, for example, and I'm just stating that just for as an example, really, anytime you open a record in a database of any user, any customer, the customer must be notified in writing when it comes to what the law says here. Even if you open a record that's based only on, you know, consumer info and just a credit card, name, address, and everything, If you go straight by the law here, the article, I guess, 43 of our Consumer Protection Code states that the customer must be informed in writing, and any type of database that's open, even by a third party, you have to inform the customer. And we also, and just as I'm going to make my comment and then go from a question, we also don't have any data breach laws or any regulations except from what is said on very broadly on the Constitution and then very broadly on how to protect data on the consumer protection laws. So it's all very broad. And under this very broad definition of how Brazilian law works on these issues, I can make the question most related on how U.S. law would handle that. Would that be a country with such a very broad perspective on privacy and consumer protection rights and the treatment of databases is not yet regulated here so far in terms of law? We have many advances in terms of technical issues, and Mr. Getchko is very aware of all of those technical advancements that we have in terms of data security. But would a country with such a broad perspective when it comes to handling personal data, would that be a country safe enough to handle data which comes from, let's say, handle data from another countries, handle private data from customers from the U.S. or from the European Union, or even to send data to such jurisdictions? That's actually my question. I'm not sure if I was able to get it right.
I simply do not know the answer to your question.
I don't know the answer either, but I would suggest an answer might lie in how the market responds to it. So from a policy perspective, if a country is positioning itself as being a BPO, business process outsourcing center, if the market doesn't respond to it, there's probably a reason why the market doesn't respond. I'm not suggesting that that's the case here. So then you need to look at why the market isn't responding, and you might start to find answers there. But I think it's the right question. Okay, we had a question here.
Thank you very much. Christos Velasco, ISOC Mexico, NACPEC.org. Well, in Mexico, we have a federal system and we have a federal data, federal consumer protection law, and it contains some provisions with regards to the protection of privacy for the consumers. And on the other hand, we have a wider range of laws at the federal level. There's approximately 33 federal laws that contain some form of privacy and confidentiality of the information. But when I hear this, all these discussions about data breach notification, it's like, I said, Mexico, we're just still in the very beginning because we're talking about a second or a third grade generation law. So it's been really interesting to see what the Europeans are doing, what the Americans, the Canadians are also pretty advanced in this field. But my question is, who should be the burden of liability with regards to the notification carried to? You mentioned some options in your presentation. What's the best way to go? Because on one hand, like there will be so many companies that will not be willing to comply with the law. And on the other hand, there will be governments that might not be able to implement those policies. These policies might sound fantastic, no, at the international level, but when it comes to national level and implementation, it's a totally different story. And especially in civil law countries like Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, this is pretty much a common law system issue. No, that is going to work well, and it's taking some time. But in Latin America, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen. Thanks.
If I can respond to your specific question. The concept, and I'm speaking only personally, that makes the most sense to me is that the entity that is in the position of what would be called the controller under EU law is the person that should be responsible for making sure that the notification is given. In U.S. law terms, the controller is the principal. the processor or subprocessor are agents of the controller. The controller is the entity that has the legal responsibility for making all of the significant decisions with respect to the processing of the data. And it seems to me that that person is where the locus of responsibility should be. I personally would not have a problem with the controller contracting with a processor or a subprocessor, that the subprocessor would give the notice as long as the principal remained ultimately responsible. And the data might be in the hands of a licensee or sub-licensee in intellectual property law terms, but it does not seem to me that this is a responsibility that can be contracted away. Ultimately, the controller or principal or owner is responsible for the security of the data, and any failures to securely process the data should be laid at the doorstep of the person who's in that position. That would be the design principle that I would proceed from.
A big thank you to the audience. I commend your staying power and your commitment to this best practice forum. A thank you to our panel, to Demi, Raj, Malcolm in his absence, to Hank for putting it together. And with that, I'll close the session. Thank you all very much.